Okay, welcome to this presentation. In audio format, I will look at the political economy of the demands of Iraq's protesters here. And I hope you were able to see the video that I have also sent on Baghdad's Tahrir Square, which was made available and translated by Workers Against Sectarianism, an activist group in Baghdad. If not, don't worry, I will start with an ethnographic account that my comrade Ansar Jassim and I wrote together when we visited Tahrir Square in November 2019. To reach Tahrir Square, the main protest area in Baghdad, we get off at the end of Saadun Street. There, the government has blocked the roads with concrete walls, not a strange sight in Baghdad. We slide through the interstices of the wall where we meet unarmed policemen. A few meters forward, we find the self-organized security of protesters. They search our bags for knives or other weapons. This is the first type of self-organization we encounter on Tahrir. They belong to the Committee for Security and are women and men who are dispersed over the whole occupied Tahrir Square. Despite the revolutionary atmosphere, troublemakers try to intermix with the protesters. The female activists who are searching us have taken up the shift for the last 3 days and are happy to be the first ones to welcome protesters and supporters. Walking out of the security tent, we go through a tunnel built in the 70s under Tahrir Square, somewhat deforming the square. Nowadays, the tunnel has been turned into an art gallery by artists taking part in the revolution. Every day, new art is made on the 100-meter-long tunnel, giving expression to the revolution and its demands. The role of women, of tuk-tuk drivers as symbols of the working class, in addition to paintings depicting Iraq's Sumerian and Assyrian history as a unifying element. Represented on the tunnel walls is also the occupied 14th-floor Turkish restaurant building, which comes to represent the high degree of self-organization of protesters. There is also the Nasb al-Hurriye, the Freedom Monument, which tells the story of Iraqi people's oppression during feudal and colonial times, until the liberation of 1958. The tunnel, like all occupied places, is decorated with flowers. At night, candles are lit for those fallen during the revolution. Self-organization is crucial. Protesters have organized traffic on the streets. There are two streets for tuk-tuk drivers and a pedestrian street. At the Liberation Square itself, dozens of tents are visible, where people from different neighborhoods, leftist activists, delegations from various cities and regions, unions of teachers, doctors and lawyers all have space for self-organizing. Political parties are not visible. In the tents, there is medical equipment, helmets and water. Here, people cook together, discussing and spreading the news from the local radio station. In the tent, behind the park of the monument, there are very different exhibitions. An exhibition by a comic artist is next to an exhibition of a mosque. Under the monument, there is a park. Here, shops have been closed for years and garbage was everywhere. Protesters fixed the power supply lines and water pipelines and painted political art on the walls. Here, we meet people who are not from Baghdad, but from other cities, coming in solidarity with the protesters, sleeping in the shops for now. They do not have much, they are living here from the takatuf of the square, an Arabic term used frequently and meaning solidarity at an equal level, shoulder to shoulder. The Turkish restaurant building opposite to the Freedom Monument is abandoned, as we are told, after its bombardment in 2003. It is close to one of the three occupied bridges, Al Jumhuriya Bridge, which directly leads to the Green Zone. The occupation of the Turkish restaurant is representative of the failed policy of the post-2003 US invasion and the corruption of a sectarian political class that hides in the Green Zone. This is the understanding of the protesters themselves, that Iqbal, one of the activists, calls mass consciousness, Wa'i Jamahiri, In the beginning of the protests in October, snipers were hiding in the building, shooting protesters. The building was then occupied to prevent the military or militias from using it again. The occupation of the building embodies the whole protest movement. The building is now being cleaned, electricity and internet are connected. On the outside, it is full of political slogans, demands from protesters, and a call to the UN. On all floors, there are spaces for sleeping, toilets being built, and shifts for security and cleaning to guarantee a permanent presence in the building. Protesters told us, quote, "We have achieved what the government has not achieved in the last 15 years," unquote. And here I end the ethnographic sequence. Today and after the forced pause due to the corona pandemic, protesters are back on the square defending and bringing forward their demands. At the same time, anti-riot forces, security forces and militias are responsible for the death of more than 600 people who died since the Iraqi revolution started on October 1st. Unlike previous protests, demonstrations and sit-ins, this revolution remains committed to its goals. So, what do people demand? In the beginning of the protest, people were demanding employment opportunities, access to clean water, a functioning electricity system, and better social services. This quickly changed into more radical demands. People now were and are asking for the downfall of the entire post-2003 political system, the removal of the old elite, who is now also responsible for the killing of protesters. People want a civil state that ends with sectarianism and an end to the theft of the country's resources. A country that they can call their own, a homeland. We need a homeland has been one of the most persistent demands of the protesters. In this presentation, I will present the political economy of these demands and protesters' performances. I will analyze the political and moral economy of the demands through the prism of ownership. I argue that the revolution is also a process where people, the protesters, take ownership over Iraq's resources in multiple ways. To do that, I will first lay out some conceptualizations of ownership and the need for an anthropological understanding of economy that is crucial to capture the revolutionary process in Iraq. I will point out how economy cannot be defined as something to be measured, but rather I follow Narodsky and Besnier, who argue that economy is an act in which people make a living through everyday life. Yes, connecting the insight of economy to the concept of ownership. In a second step, I will look at the history of ownership in Iraq, mainly the ownership of land and oil. Linking this history of ownership to today's revolution, I outline what the demand for a homeland means in economic terms. I show how the call for a homeland in the revolution, how the building of the homeland, is about establishing vital relations of ownership to Iraq's resources, thereby establishing emotional and moral belonging, a part of what seems to be the economic control over the country's resources. So, as narrated in the introductory ethnographic account, protesters were taking care of the streets, organizing health services, cleaning services, and other social services for free. Also, in their language, protesters are denouncing those who have stolen from the people. There's a famous slogan saying, "In the name of religion, the thieves have robbed us." The language of protesters makes very clear that the country has been taken from them, and ordinary citizens have been left at the mercy of leaders within political parties, militias, etc., to make a living possible. I contend that the revolution is a means to take back what people feel has been taken from them. I argue that the revolution is also about establishing a relation of ownership between ordinary people and Iraq's most vital resources. But first, how to understand ownership? If we look into how ownership has been conceptualized so far, we see different approaches. First, there's the concept of ownership in liberal approaches, which is based on the idea of private property ownership. This approach, for example by Sigrist and Müller, defines property as a bundle of strong and absolute exclusive rights pertaining to an individual. Others underline how property rights are, quote, fundamental for markets, unquote, in Alston. It is thereby the title to land that can, quote, further raise appropriable rents and land value, unquote. Thus, here it is the idea of exclusive rights that only an individual can hold, as well as the idea of profitability as a result from holding property rights. This understanding of ownership is an understanding shared in much of the liberal literature. It is also the dominant understanding underpinning the modern state in how it regulates ownership exclusively in terms of private property. One of the fathers of liberal property law is John Locke. His theory explores what permits people to acquire and exercise control over things, for example, land. Thereby, he refers to natural laws justifying private property rights. To use land, he says, it has to be made exclusively into one's own. While Locke thus refuses to have any political authority decide, for him it is the labor that, when put to use to produce goods, is what justifies ownership over resources, such as land. Therefore, property rights are central to improve the land. And improve here is meant as making land more profitable. Locke's theory is criticized in different ways. Here I will limit myself to two brief critiques. First, the Marxist critique, and second, a critique that comes from within settler colonial studies. So Marxist scholar Alan Wood, in The Origins of Capitalism, debunks Locke's idea that labor on land is what justifies taking land as one's own property. According to Wood, it is not labor, but rather profitable labor, in Locke's theory, that would make private property productive in the capitalist sense. It therefore serves the capitalist push for extracting surplus value. Indeed, Marx sees land ownership as central to capitalism. And I will only remind us here that the enclosure of common land in England throughout different time periods, growing strong in the 17th century England, dispossessed the peasantry and robbed them of their means of production, namely land. Important to note here is how the process of acquiring private property during this period was not a natural process. For Marx, this is robbery and had everything to do with capital accumulation, namely the initial primitive accumulation. Within settler colonial studies, it is agreed that private property ownership also serves capitalist accumulation. However, it is pointed out that it is important to note how capitalist accumulation takes place within the colonial context. And here I refer to Brenna Bandar, who in her book Colonial Lives of Property argues that, quote, property law holds a unique and distinctive place in Enlightenment thought and ensuing discourses of modernity. It operates as a set of both techniques and mechanisms encapsulated in legislation, legal judgments, and myriad everyday practices of ownership that have structured colonial capitalist modes of accumulation, unquote. So much of the literature in settler colonial studies concurs with Bandar on the idea that private property ownership originates from European Enlightenment and modernization discourses. In this process, ownership is central to colonial capitalist profit-making. In opposition to this liberal colonial understanding of ownership, a different type of ownership is presented. It is in the context of Canada or Turtle Island, US or Israel-Palestine, where ownership is defined according to the indigenous people of those lands. Thereby, it becomes clear that it is not solely according to a limited understanding of economic profitability in which ownership can be justified. Rather, ownership entails multiple ties that are established along historical, ancestral, social, and emotional, but also economic values. However, in this context, economy is not defined in a narrow liberal capitalist sense where ownership is tied to profitability. What then does economy entail? And here let me take a moment to point out how anthropology shifts our understanding of the economy. For a historical view on economy, Timothy Mitchell has outlined well how economy, quote, required a great work of imagination on the part of economists and econometricians to find methods of representing every relationship constituting a nation's economic life in giving each one a value, unquote. Mitchell looks at the knowledge production on economy and the empirical context of Egypt, and wonders how every action can be measured in economic terms and what counts as gross national product and what not. Ultimately, he points out how economy, as defined by most economists, excludes spheres of activity, exchange, and consumption that does not involve money. It also excludes the state, which engages in representing all of these economic transactions. For Mitchell, therefore, the economic discourse functions to maintain, quote, the difference between monetary and non-monetary, the economic and the personal, the public and the private, unquote. In reality, these categories, however, cannot encapsulate the complex ways of what he calls hybrid lives that cut across all of these categories. In a similar way, Narodsky and Besnier rethink economy through an ethnographic lens that runs counter to the logic of measurement and comparability often employed in economic anthropology. Thereby, they redefine economy in a beautiful way. And I like to quote them here, quote, making a living is about making people in their physical, social, spiritual, affective and intellectual dimensions. It is about the forms of human interaction that make different kinds of resources available, although often unequally through social relations of production, distribution and consumption. It is about struggles and stabilization around the worth of people and how to make life worth living. Unquote. If we take this definition and rethink what ownership means away and in contrast to a mere idea of private property relations, then I contend that ownership relations are everyday, emotional, and simultaneously economic relations over resources that enable and sustain people's lives in valuable ways. What does this mean in the context of the Iraqi Revolution? So let us look at the origins of private property ownership in Iraq, and here I speak in liberal terms, as according to Marxist terms, this is called the history of the origins of robbery in Iraq, a term that I would say is also valid in settler colonial studies. I follow Marxist terminology here. The history of the robbery of Iraq's resources goes back to British colonialism. Let me therefore start with land settlement laws. The Ottomans had introduced a new land settlement law in 1858. However, this was not realized until the British revived it during the First World War. For Iraqi Kurdistan, Martin van Brunessen points to the fact that the British occupation in Iraq opened the land registration offices since, quote, an accurate land registration was seen as a prerequisite for revenue collection, unquote. Also, Hanna Batatu notes how legislation was instrumental in, quote, the placing of property on firmer juridical foundations, unquote. This kind of rationality is very obvious, is a very obvious characteristic during the process of colonialism in Iraq. It is visible when going through the policy of British commissions and experts who argued that increasing production in agriculture requires settlement laws. We can also look at statements such as Dawson, a British representative, who in 1931 oversees the land policies. In 1932, he states that, quote, only a fraction of the cultivated region is somewhat uncertainly held on tapu tenure, while throughout the overwhelming balance, land is for the most part occupied and cultivated on no legal tenure at all, unquote, in Mahdi. We can find here quite clearly John Locke's rationality in the statements, in which land registration is tied to land profitability. So another question here is, who in Iraq, including Kurdistan, profited from these land registrations as private ownership? Historian Sarah Pursley, in her book Familiar Futures, Time, Selfhood and Sovereignty in Iraq, points out how on the one hand the British revived Ottoman laws, and on the other hand they went against the, quote, legal modernization by the Ottoman government, unquote. Here it was a tribal disputes regulation that became part of Iraqi legislation. Also, according to Slaglet and Farouk Slaglet, historians of Iraq, this meant that the British strengthened the authority of those people they designated as heads of tribes and landlords. These heads of tribes were then given tenureship over vast areas of land. The result was that large areas of land became, quote, the personal possession of selected tribal leaders and were subsequently registered in tapu, unquote. Tapu is the Ottoman term for land registration offices. At the same time, the collective character of tribes changed towards individualization and strengthened the authority of sheikhs or aras, so the heads of tribes, as absentee landowners. What is noteworthy here is that British colonialism imposed a very narrow definition of ownership in Iraq that is based exclusively on private property. Other forms of ownership are not acknowledged as a form of ownership itself. It can be concluded, therefore, that property law is a crucial tool for colonial capital accumulation in Iraq. The British had created sheikhs and aras who were given land as private property in exchange for taxes and political loyalty. Not only could the British extract surplus value in these ways, they also strengthened political control over the country. So, narrating this imposition of private property ownership, I have focused much on the British policies and their rationale. Of course, these did not remain undisputed. In fact, there have been many revolts and resistance in the Iraqi popular history against British colonialism. However, due to time limits, I will refrain from going into these now, but I recommend you to look into the writings of Raider Visser, Slaglet and Eric Davis for an account of historical revolts. Yes, so while private property ownership was firmly established throughout British colonialism, it was also implemented with Iraq's most wanted resource, which is oil, that was soon to be exploited, excluding the rights of Iraq's population to it. Let me outline this history of the theft of oil from the Iraqi people. So it was mainly BP, British Petroleum, who in the 1930s built the Iraqi oil sector that then created an interdependency of Iraq to the capitalist world market. Timothy Mitchell writes how the strategy of British Petroleum was to keep Iraqi oil production underdeveloped and refrain from exploiting Iraqi oil reserves. BP wanted to keep price fluctuations low and the oil price high. Within this colonial game, the Iraqi population had no say. The oil went through two pipelines to Syria and from there to the Mediterranean. In 1958, Abdul Karim Qasim, the first post-colonial Iraqi-owned government, came to power. One of the major objectives of Qasim was Iraqi control over its own oil resources. However, this was owned, of course, by British Petroleum. So he entered into a struggle over oil with them. Karim Qasim attempted to convince Iraqi Petroleum Company, which was jointly owned by major global companies, of which British Petroleum was the strongest. He convinced them to export Mosul's oil through Basra, but this was rejected. BP was not interested to give Iraq any sovereignty over its oil exports. At the same time, BP already knew of the large oil reserves of southern Iraq, but kept this as a further secret. Still, Qasim laid the groundwork for the nationalization of Iraqi oil. He implemented laws that established the state's sovereignty over oil fields in 1961. He also created the National Oil Company, Iraq National Oil Company. And this is parallel to the British-controlled Iraq Petroleum Company. So what happened then, the nationalization of oil could only be accomplished in 1972, at a time when Iraq had acquired the expertise and infrastructure to accomplish this. However, at that time, the Ba'athist regime had also came to power in Iraq. And from 1979 onwards, this regime was under now ex-dictator Saddam Hussein. Hussein used the new income from oil wealth to not only build a brutal surveillance state that provided for its citizens, while denying them political rights and also terrorizing people. Saddam used the oil to build state capitalism as the food imports were beginning to rise under his rule. By the time the United Nations imposed international sanctions from 1991 to 2003, or what Joy Gordon calls the Invisible War, where she explains that Iraq produced only one third of the food it consumed. This means that Iraq was massively dependent on food imports. And here I don't even go into the human death toll. Just Joy Gordon speaks of over 500,000 children who died as the result of the sanctions. She explains that, quote, the sanctions regime it imposed in conjunction with the massive bombing campaign of 91 destroyed nearly all of Iraq's infrastructure, industrial capacity, agriculture, telecommunications, and critical public services, particularly electricity and water treatment, unquote. In 1995, the Oil for Food program was introduced, and this meant that Iraqi lives were tied to the global oil market, as then oil was exported and in return, food was imported and distributed to Iraqi citizens. The sanctions period ended with the US invasion to Iraq. As many scholars have pointed out, Iraq's oil resources played a crucial part in this invasion. After 2003, a situation of extreme insecurity and looting had been created. The 100 orders of Paul Bremer, head of the coalition provisional government in Iraq, brought about a dismantling of the Iraqi state and a further privatization campaign. This resulted in a 90% drop in agricultural production and again a massive rise in imports. Until now, whether you are in the north in Kurdistan or the south of Iraq, you rarely find Iraqi food items on sale, as mostly Iranian and Turkish products are the most common on offer. After the US invasion, it was also sectarianism, an outgrowth of the 2003 US invasion, whose exponents viewed Iraq as divided between Sunni, Shia, and Kurds, and institutionalized a sectarian system. This arrangement fueled an insurgency, sectarian violence, and the rise of ISIS, all while an Iraqi exiled elite, in close affiliation with the US and later also Iran, exploited Iraq's resources. Not only this ruling elite, the Iraqi government, it is also militia leaders, including al-Sadr, who today is part of Iraq's ruling class. They are established within the government and distribute the country's wealth according to sectarian and party loyalties. It's also called the Muhasasa Ta'ifiyya sectarian apportionment system. This wealth, the country's wealth, rests for 99% on oil income. So shifting global market prices for oil directly affect the income of Iraqi state servants, who make up almost 40% of the population. At the same time, less than 1% of the Iraqi population is employed in the oil sector. International companies insist on bringing their own employees. Those who remain unemployed are therefore largely Iraq's youth. It has also been this impoverished youth who had to bear the brunt of the sectarian violence. They had found both a source of income and a sense of belonging in the militias. Many of them were propelled by sectarian ideology. However, having witnessed the ongoing theft through militias and the ruling elite, a massive part is taking... many of them are taking part now in the revolution today. They are demanding a homeland and a secular state that would allow for an all-inclusive Iraqi identity and a more just distribution of the country's wealth. The youth, therefore, is claiming ownership over Iraq's resources. Those who are calling for a homeland today do not only break with sectarianism, an ideology that has separated the lower classes to the ruling class's benefit. They also resist the ruling class's oil deals with multinational companies, which are intransparent to the wider Iraqi public. Large portions of the revenue from these pacts, which make up almost all of the state's income, remain in the pockets of the ruling elite. The ruling class, protesters charge, is stealing from the lower and the middle classes. At the same time, they have opened up the country to products that have decimated the local economy and left no say to Iraqis over their own country's resources. We need a homeland, then, is a call to take ownership over all facets of life from the ruling class and strip away the imprints of war and sectarianism that have destroyed the country. Iraqi protesters have also called for a boycott of foreign import products, thereby rejecting that their lives are being tied to the global oil market's needs. To protesters, calling for a homeland means resisting the sellout of their country. The sellout, they decry, can be spotted in the streets of Baghdad, abandoned by the state, with garbage and vacant buildings and once glorious heritage site. Iraqi protesters are not only taking ownership over Iraq's infrastructure, as in the case of the Turkish restaurant, to economically profit from it, They are establishing a relation of economical, that is also emotional ownership over the buildings, the streets, their own health services that enables them to meaningfully sustain and live their lives. A narrow liberal economic account cannot account for the kind of ownership that Iraqis are establishing during this revolution. As I described in the introductory ethnographic episode, in Baghdad's occupied Tahrir Square, protesters have taken it upon themselves to construct something different. They have not only been installing electricity and internet and organizing cleaning shifts, but also they have built a vibrant artistic culture through a revolutionary cinema, book tents, and internal discussions about the country's future. These primarily young, impoverished demonstrators are not only calling for a homeland that belongs to them and which they own, they have also started building that very homeland. And yes, here I would like to thank you for listening and end the presentation. Thank you.